from office to apartment to retail to industrial data centers. Of course, JLL sits at the center of it all. You are one of the largest real estate services companies in the world, 113,000 employees across 80 countries. Christian Ulbrich, global CEO of JLL, thank you so much for being here. Welcome to the Property Play.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm delighted.
Well, I want to get to a ton of big picture items on this, but we have to get to the news. There's just so much news right now. You obviously, JLL has a big footprint in the Middle East. So I want to get to that first off. How are you being impacted there, both in your physical buildings and in the financials of operating in that corridor right now?
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, I would say that's a human tragedy, what's happening there. And it's also a tragedy from a point that the region was on a really strong growth trajectory. And this is at the moment at least interrupted for the time being. Let's all hope that this is coming to an end very, very swiftly. We have a lot of people based there. So I reached out to our leaders over the weekend when the news broke and got firsthand how the situation is kind of playing to them. And, you know, it depends a little bit where they are based. It seems to be much calmer in Riyadh than it is in Dubai. But they're all safe, which is most important. And then let's think about the business impacts once that is over. First and foremost, we want our people to be safe. And what the business impact will be depends very heavily on how long will that take.
But we're already seeing the impact in interest rates.
Yes.
And that's going to affect commercial real estate almost immediately. What are you going to see in that? What is your hope and what are your fears?
Well, we entered this conflict with a very strong outlook for 2026. The economy was doing really well globally and particularly well here in the US. Inflation was coming down, still a bit sticky, but directionally coming down in the US, very much coming down in Europe, interest rates coming down in Europe. So the outlook was super strong. So we are entering this new period of uncertainty from a position of strength. That interest rates have increased over the last couple of days is a normal reaction when you have such a major geopolitical conflict. But I wouldn't be overly concerned just on that movement for now. As I said, it depends very much whether that conflict is being put to bed within the next 2-3 weeks or whether that will continue. If it continues, we have a different situation.
Well, it's going to affect how investors see the markets, what they're putting their money toward. And that's kind of the second big news story that we're dealing with right now as well, which is private capital. And private capital kind of pulling back and potentially going into commercial real estate. Now, JLL has its own REIT. It has, you know, a place for that money to go. Are you already starting to see a shift of private capital into commercial real estate, even just in the last month or two?
Well, I wouldn't say that we can really demonstrate that. But interestingly enough, I was yesterday in a meeting with a couple of very large investors here in New York, and we were debating exactly that topic. Real assets are coming across as incredibly attractive in an environment of uncertainty we are currently in, and that private credit situation is literally driving people more into the real assets. So yeah, potentially that could be something where real estate or real assets are beneficiary.
And which real assets would be the most beneficiary?
Well, I guess, as usual in those situations, you would go down to the most conservative route. So you would invest into the best buildings and the best locations. And that is irrespective.
Is that office, multifamily,
well, that
everything?
Well, irrespective of the asset class, I would say. I mean, surely if you invest into a grade A multifamily building, you have a very broad income stream from all the different tenants, that the highest level of certainty. But you can also invest into a great logistics space, great warehouse, great office building. But they will probably focus very much on the core assets.
And so that would be private REITs, not the publicly traded REITs, correct, like JLL has?
Well, it can be through REITs. It can also be direct investments into real estate.
I'm trying to get at the play here. What would investors want to do in this situation?
Well, I don't think there's this one investor. I think you have different investors having different strategies. And so smaller investors will go into public REITs, slightly bigger investors will go into private REITs. And then you will have the institutional investors and the ultra high net worth individuals. They will invest directly into real estate.
So, and JLL has had a fantastic couple of quarters coming off your last one. I could get into the numbers, but you could get into the numbers as well. You did very well. What are you seeing in the real estate recovery that's playing into that? In what specific sectors? Because, you know, we're seeing some wobbling a little bit in multifamily offices under this constant recovery. Data centers, we could argue that a lot, depending on who you're talking to. Data centers are either the best investment or the absolute worst. What has been driving your revenue?
Well, I think it was pretty much across the board. We, as you know, we run our company across four large segments, which we show publicly, and all of them are performing really well. The investment management, the least, but I think that business has gone through the trough and has a very strong outlook now going forward as valuations are coming back again and more equity is being raised. But when you go to our three large business segments, our real estate management services, our capital market services, and our leasing services, all of them had really, really strong multiple quarters now, and that is based on pretty much all the asset classes. We have overall in the company, we have a focus on offices roughly 40%, but when you look into our capital markets businesses, offices is less than 50%. And so multifamily is there very important, industrial is very important. And so it's across the board, we see a recovery for real estate, and we are able to take additional market share, and we very strongly believe it is on the back of our very early investment for over a decade now. We have invested heavily into technology and data, and on the back of that, we can provide our clients with just better insights, and that is driving our market share gains.
But what worries you the most?
Well, what worries me the most is literally the amount of conflict and disruption in the world.
The volatility. Every time you think it's going to get better, it gets worse.
Yeah. Well, and actually what is happening is that those existing conflicts are not solved. We add new ones. And so uncertainty is not great for the economy. As you know, economy has a lot to do with sentiment. And we were just kind of getting to terms with the existing challenges in the world, and we're off to a very good start, and now we have a new conflict which is sizable, and therefore this adds now additional uncertainty, and that is not good for the economy.
And it's not just in, you talk about the office space recovering, you're mostly in Class A office, right? So you're pretty protected in that realm because there's still very strong demand for Class A. Do you see any kind of play in Class B, or do you just want to stick to safety?
Well, what you are seeing is that there is not enough offerings in grade A space, especially at the upper end of the grade A space. There is much more demand for that space than new build is coming to market. There is very, very little new build. And this is not only in the US. This is something which you see pretty much all across the world. And so at the end of the day, the more demand is there, the more there are opportunities arising that you take an existing B building and upgraded it to something which is A or even at the upper end.
And does that pencil? Is it worth it? Is it?
Well, it is a question of how rents are developing. I mean, when you see, we see here in the New York market a 94% premium of the newest, most sustainable buildings compared to
existing. People still care about sustainability?
Oh, most definitely they care about sustainability. You have to define sustainability also on the level of how much energy consumption does a building have. And when you see how energy prices are going up very significantly, it makes a difference what the energy costs of a buildings are, so, even if you don't believe in all the other aspects
of sustainability. Right, so if the political winds are shifted one way, it doesn't matter because the financials of sustainability have not changed.
And that was always something which we try to bring across. Sustainability is not a political question. It's a very much a fundamental business question. And from a business aspect, it makes a lot of sense to place your people into buildings which are sustainable, which is a low energy consumption, and which do not pollute the world.
So there are opportunities then to convert that Class B if it works financially. Multifamily, which JLL is also in, has, you know, seen some weakening, especially because of the economy, because of jobs right now. Household development is not what it's been. Households are shrinking. People are staying home. Younger people are moving in with their parents. We're seeing rents start to wobble a bit. Are you concerned about that going forward? We saw this tremendous amount of new supply come into the market. It's almost through, but it is really having an impact, and we're starting to see even more concessions.
This is not a question which you can easily answer across the board, because at the end of the day, location plays a very important role. And, you know, when I sometimes fly into a city and I see how cities are expanding and how far off the city center you see these new multifamily developments, I kind of wonder who is going to live here. And therefore, we have to be careful that we're not throwing everything into one basket. If we elevate ourselves a little bit, generally speaking, that asset class will continue to be a successful asset class. But the ground rules of real estate investment, that location is playing a very important role, and that you also have to be mindful of which target clients are you addressing. Are you addressing the upper end, the maximum affluent people? Are you addressing the middle class? Are you addressing the lower middle class? You have to deliver a product which fits to your target market. The challenge what we have, that the cost of constructions have gone up so significantly, and there is frankly not much hope that this will revert. And so if then income levels are not growing at the same level, the barriers to entry for people to get into those assets as a buyer, but also as a tenant, is obviously going up. And so that's why it's so important that you are clear about your target market.
And I have to hit data centers, because I have that argument with everyone. Good buy, bad buy, medium, where do you see data centers right now?
Well, first and foremost, there's a tremendous demand for the output of data centers. That is most important. So on that end, that's a bit like if you have a massive queue for people who need office space, that's the starting point. One of the things we need to consider here is that the technology evolvement is very, very fast. And frankly, I'm not in a position to judge what that will do to a data center which is developed today. Is that then in 10 years from now outdated, or is there still usage for that?
Well, that's the argument, because if AI is supposed to make everything more efficient, wouldn't that include AI? Which, if you make AI more efficient and you make the chips more efficient, maybe they just plain don't need as much space.
Potentially, at the moment, the demand for data center space is growing at those massively high numbers. And at the same time, the restriction from the lack of available grid, available power, limits the amount of new development. If we hadn't had this massive lack of power and grid, we would see much more development.
But you don't feel that we're overdeveloping?
I'm not in a position to be deep enough into the technology to understand how that demand curve will go. Yeah. But I would say, when I look at the amount of need for data center capacity, when you think about, you know, the new module from Claude which came to market, what you can do with that, if that is being scaled and we all use it, the amount of data it needs to feed it, I would say we still need many more data centers in the short term.
All right, so you brought up Claude, which means I have to get into AI now, which you knew I was getting to. A couple of weeks ago, or last month, your stock got positively crushed, along with all the other real estate services firms, because all of a sudden everyone decided, oh, we're not going to need real estate services firms anymore. We're not going to need the people. They're all going to be automated. And just like they hit the software stocks, they hit the commercial real estate stocks. I was listening to you earlier today, talking to your investors. You called it unfair. Why do you think there is such great fear in your sector over this? And what do you need to do about it to ensure investors that there isn't? And then, of course, you talked about stock buybacks.
Yeah, I think that is the easiest answer to the concern which people have raised with regards to the viability of our business model in the age of AI, that we look at the current stock price, which prompted us to do, for the first time in the history of this company, over and above our usual buybacks, an accelerated stock buyback program. I mean, we looked very hard once again at our business model to identify whether we are missing a trick here, whether that is justified what the market did. And I can only say we cannot see any significant risk of disruption to our business model. In fact, for the time being, we are a clear winner of the AI age because we have invested very heavily early on ahead of our competitors into our technology and data platform. And we have developed multiple AI tools, agents within our business model. And that is one of the reasons why we win so much market share. It's one of the reasons why we have this acceleration of margin profile within our company, because we are increasing our productivity. So for now, we are a clear AI winner. So from being an AI winner to an AI loser, I think there is something in the middle. And for now, we believe that we will stay on that AI winning streak for the foreseeable future.
But you told investors here, you said that you thought that the impact of AI was being overdone. You said they are overestimating the impact of AI on our business. And yet, you're leaning heavily into it. You've got Blackbird, Falcon, I want to get to what all those are. I don't understand why they're all birds, but maybe you could tell me. But if you're leaning so heavily into it to make yourself so much more productive, why do you think that it's being overestimated what that impact would be?
Well, I mean, at the moment, the market took us down instead of up. So I would have expected that the market is taking our stock price up because we are a clear winner of AI and not a loser on AI.
Well, they think you're going to lose people. Will you lose people?
We as an organization, I'm not sure that we will lose people. What we do is we are able to increase our revenues quite significantly without adding a lot of people, which I guess is a good thing from a shareholder's perspective. And we are creating new roles and new career opportunities for our existing people because we are training our people very much around AI tools. We have trained over 30,000 of our employees on AI tools already, and we are consistently beefing up the type of training they are getting from a base training to a quite advanced training so that they can take the best of all these new AI applications which are out there.
So I actually got a tour of your various applications. Someone was kind enough from JLL to walk me through it on the computer. And it's really fascinating, some of the things that you can do, which is basically walk through entire neighborhoods and communities and show valuations of, you know, if you take a property, what's around it, what are the prices around it, who's living in the buildings, all that kind of stuff. What is the coolest stuff that you have that you're implementing that your employees can really lean on to make them not only more productive, but more insightful in their investments?
Well, as a father of three children, I know that you have to love all your children. And so if I take that theme, I don't think that I would pick one of those. I am fascinated with the amount of data which real estate is offering, and it's almost an untouched treasure. You know, not many people are really tapping into all of that data, and we are on a journey that we collect every piece of data which is you possibly can collect when you operate buildings, and you translate all that information into valuable advice for your clients. And although we have done that now on that journey for more than 10 years, I would say we are still at the beginning. And so there is so much more potential, but the train has left the station. So for those companies who haven't gotten on that train, it will be very hard to follow us.
So when you guide a company through this kind of thing, which is really, you know, altering in every way. I want to get back to where you started, because that really informs everything any leader of a large company such as yours, a CEO, would do. You started in your family way back when, sort of tangentially related to real estate in wood. Tell me where you came from and how that's informed you.
Well, I mean, I grew up as a child in a family where my parents were running a timber business, and in any small family business, it's probably quite normal that the life of the family plays very much in the company. So when other kids were playing wherever, I was playing kind of in our warehouses, running around in the warehouse or driving the forklifts when I was getting older. And I could observe how my parents were running the company. You know, you pick a lot of things up from your parents.
Like what?
Well, I think first and foremost, values. I would argue that my parents were very much value driven. When you run a warehouse, you do not employ only kind of white-collar, highly educated people. The spectrum of people who were working for my parents was from educated to the lower end of education. My father treated everybody the same. He was always super friendly. He was always very precise. And so people felt comfortable. And I think I took that very much on board. There is no reason to be harsh to people. There's no reason to be unfriendly to people. We have to accept the differences of people and then try to get the most out of them according to their abilities.
And how do you do that?
Well, exactly that. You should respect every person as an individual. And not everybody has to become a CFO or the best salesperson. But, you know, people have talent and you try to develop that talent to their best abilities.
So how do you guide that then through a new culture where so much is automated, where so much is now moving into AI that is threatening to replace people and the way they analyze things and the way they get data, and maybe you don't need as many people? You know, there was something in the news recently. East Dill, another real estate company, was acquired by Savills. And that was seen as actually a people play because East Dill doesn't have the kind of data-driven access that JLL does. And they were not, you know, it just seemed to a lot of folks that I've talked to in the marketplace that that was a strange purchase when everyone is looking toward AI and less people. What did you think of that deal?
Well, I cannot comment about the motivation for Savills to do that acquisition. What I would say is Eastdil was what we would call a monoliner, a company which was only offering capital market services in real estate. And you may recall that we did a similar transaction back in 2019 where we bought a much bigger monoliner, HFF. And the reason why HFF was willing to do that transaction at the time is because they realized that they have limited access to data. They didn't do any leasing. They didn't do any property management. They didn't do any other services. And if you want to advise your clients on the highest and best level, you need to have broader knowledge about the real estate world. And therefore, it's very hard for monoliner. So when I heard about this transaction, I felt that this was kind of just a demonstration that what HFF did back in 2019 was maybe with great foresight, but it was the right thing to do. And now Eastdil is doing the same thing, that they are kind of putting themselves into the arms of a broader-based business. Now, the large players in the US weren't apparently not available, so they had to pivot to a smaller player from the UK.
Interesting. So then going forward, when you think again about how this all affects not just your people, but your spaces, your office spaces, how they're going to change. I know JLL has a lot to do with how, you know, urban development, how we see the new central business districts. How do you see AI and the changing workforce and the new way that we go to the office transforming our central business districts? And what is JLL doing to, you know, monetize that?
Well, first and foremost, I would say that central business districts have always been under the threat to constantly evolve, to change, to adapt. We had multiple incidences and developments in the past which forced central business districts to change. If you go a long term back, it was very hard to access the city centers. And then in the 60s and the 70s, communities decided to kind of cut massive roads into those cities so that people can easily access central business districts by car. Just think about, we were talking earlier about Boston, how Boston was when there was still that big road between the water and
the city
center.
Well, it was designed to keep enemies out because they'd never be able to find where they're going. And to me, it's still designed to keep enemies and me out.
Okay. So then there was a trend where we were saying, well, central business districts need to become much more livable, walkable, convenient from that end, not only to people who want to pass through with their car. And so we were taking all those roads away and we were trying to make it much more convenient, more cycle friendly, more pedestrian friendly. That is on the same journey when we said it doesn't make sense that central business districts are completely emptied by people living there. So we were kind of reinforcing that you have a much more a mix of offices, stores, residential and all kinds of entertainment in the central business district, so that it is not kind of quieting down at 6-7 o'clock in the evening, but that it is a vibrant environment literally all around the clock. And so, going back to your questions around AI, I'm not concerned about that will have a massive impact on central business districts. It's just another reason to constantly stay on the front foot, to kind of change and adapt.
To evolve.
I think COVID was much harder than what we see now coming from AI. So let's see that as just another thing, another positivity. I mean, if you go back to San Francisco, what AI has done, it has brought tenants back into the city center. I mean, the performance of San Francisco's office market in the last couple of quarters was predominantly driven by AI companies.
So how do you envision what the downtowns are going to look like?
Well, I think the downtowns will become much more livable. It will be much more pedestrian friendly. It will be much more cycle friendly. You will try to bring more green into the downtowns. Also, from a climate change perspective, that's quite important that you kind of...
Are you allowed to say that anymore, climate change?
I think we should always be allowed to state with the facts.
And I say that because you and I first met in Glasgow.
Yeah.
At COP26, and that was all we talked about was sustainability, not just from a business perspective, but from a global health perspective. Obviously, political winds, not just in the U.S., but across the globe, have shifted dramatically. But you were a big supporter of that. I remember talking to you about how passionate you were about that. How do you continue to push forward on that agenda when business is kind of against it now?
I'm not sure that business is against it. There's a little bit of a change in the political rhetoric around it.
Maybe they're just not allowed to say that they're for it.
Well, I think that's an important point. I don't know whether they're not allowed to talk about it, but they're not talking about it. But we don't see any of our major clients scaling back on their ambitions to get to a much more sustainable real estate footprint. And so we are helping them to get to that point. So I'm still very positive that the trajectory is kind of moving on, and that we see a great, great performance on the carbon footprint from the large corporates around the world.
So given what's happening globally, this something, obviously a political pullback, it's good to hear that companies are still involved in sustainability because it, you know, helps their bottom line, if anything else. But what do you see as the biggest risks? We see, you know, more intense weather. We see more intense flooding. We see more intense storms. Are you more concerned than you were, say, when we met 4 or 5 years ago than you were then?
I would say the journey to reduce the carbon footprint, which is in the hands of the large corporates of the world, is still there, and it has accelerated and evolved the way I would have hoped for. As I said, I don't see any slowdown. I'm not an expert on climate change. I read, as we all do, about the floodings. I notice the heat waves. I notice all these storms, the increase of massive storms around the world.
And the impacts on your properties.
And the impacts on the properties. I mean, here in the U.S., it is most notable around the insurance premiums, which are going up very significantly. And so people will react to it. You know, if insurance becomes too expensive in a certain location, then the value of that location will come down inevitably. And if you are living in an area which is consistently flooded, we have some of those areas across the world, but when you think about some of the places in Asia which are flooded on a regular basis, people will react and will leave those areas. And so I think there's a lot of reason to kind of embrace the facts which are there and react on those facts. And, you know, the public markets are always very good on looking at those things. So you will see ongoing kind of activity to protect your investments by placing those investments into those areas which are less impacted by climate change.
I guess, whatever it takes. Getting back again to overall volatility, though, we talk about so many things. As I think about what we've just spoken of, it's just constant and consistent volatility. So just, you know, it's not often that investors get to sit in the room with someone like you and get to say, what are we getting wrong? What are real estate investors out there getting wrong about the market? And what do you see as the greatest play where they should be directing their attention?
Well, I think There was a time when interest rates were coming down literally months over months to a point that in some areas of the world, when you think about the Eurozone, where we had negative interest rates, and in Japan we had negative interest rates, in Switzerland we had negative interest rates, and in the US we had very low interest rates, where people were thinking that they can just buy real estate and then go on holiday, and then they look at it again in 5 or 10 years from now and everything is working well. Investing into real estate, you are investing into something you have to operate. A large office building needs to be operated exactly the same way as a large shopping center needs to be operated, a large business park needs to be operated, a very large compound of multifamily needs to be operated. It is a business. And for every business you are investing in, you either should be the expert yourself or you should get yourself an expert. Otherwise, you will lose money. And I think that has been a little bit the misunderstanding, that people replaced real estate investment for bond investments.
So what is the great play?
Well, the great play is that you partner yourself up with really, really knowledgeable people. You do your homework, you analyze the data so that you are really taking a decision which is grounded on data. And on that basis, you place your money. And, you know, there are lots of things you can do. But you have to do it based on facts, based on data.
And do you lean into AI for that data?
You lean into AI for that data because it makes it much quicker for you to get to the bottom of it. But first and foremost, you need to have the data. AI doesn't help you if you don't have the data. And so, you know, there are plenty of things. The amount of geopolitical turmoil, the supply chain issues, which we are now seeing again with the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, will continue to bring a boost to the nearshoring, to the bringing things closer to home, which means there's a tremendous opportunity to invest into modern logistic facilities, into modern industrial space, all those things which will come closer to home again. So you will see that asset class in front of a real nice kind of uptick over multiple years now going forward.
So in volatility, there is opportunity.
Definitely.
Christian Ulbrich, Global CEO of JLL, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.